You're listening to Unceded Airwaves by the Indigenous Collective at CITR 101.9 FM. Unceded Airwaves is broadcasting from the traditional, ancestral, unceded, and current lands of the Hunkaminam-speaking Musqueam people.
Thanks for listening to Unceded Airwaves by the Indigenous Collective on CITR 101.9 FM. Broadcasting from the unceded territories of the Musqueam, Squamish, and Tsleil-Waututh peoples. Our opening song today was You Got to Run, Spirit of the Wind by Buffy St. Marie and Tanya Tagak.
Today's episode is about Indigenous politics at UBC. We're examining Indigenous representation on campus, university land acknowledgements, and student experiences.
Unceded Airwaves is brought to you by the Indigenous Collective, a group of Indigenous and non-Indigenous allied volunteers. We're dedicated to amplifying underheard voices and decolonizing media. Find us on Facebook or Twitter at Unceded Airwaves.
I'm Jamuna Gale Tamang. I'm Nepali, Dene Métis, and Ukrainian, and I was born very close to here on Tsleil-Waututh territory.
I'm Amanda, and I'm a settler from the Chicago suburbs, the traditional territories of the Miami, Potawatomi, and Peoria peoples. I live and study here on unceded Coast Salish, the unceded Coast Salish territories.
Dreen Gweezy, Autumn Schnell Vilji, Chief Jim Cooey, Janet Cooey, Jacqueline Cooey, Shadeji. Hi, my name is Autumn Schnell, and I was born and raised on Treaty 6 territory in Amiskwichi with Skyakin. Originally I am from Treaty 11 territory, and I am Gwich'in and Inuvialuit. But now I live here on unceded ancestral and traditional Musqueam, Squamish, and Tsleil-Waututh lands, and I feel really grateful to be an uninvited guest here for about 2.5 years. Yeah, do you want to go next, Kaz?
Sure. Hey, I'm Kaz. I'm a non-status Cree born in Kelowna, BC, but I've grown up mostly on the coast of BC, all over the place, moved around most of my life.
Beautiful. And do you want to go next, Karen?
Sure. My name is Karen Rose Thomas, and I'm from the Tsleil-Waututh Nation in North Vancouver. I have ties to Squamish and Semiahmoo Nations as well.
I'm Steph. I'm from the Squamish Nation, born and raised on Squamish territory.
And I'm Jess. I'm a settler from Madison, Wisconsin, the traditional home of the Menominee, Ojibwe, Potawatomi, and Ho-Chunk peoples.
We have two new people in studio with us today. Karen Thomas is an anthropology student here from UBC. Thanks for coming and joining us. And Kaz Tayabji is an art student. He's helping us establish a new Indigenous committee at UBC, and they're going to help us in our conversation about Indigenous representation on campus. Welcome.
Thank you.
Yeah, thanks for having us.
First, we have a pre-taped interview with Rodney Little Mustache and Laura Beaudry. Rodney ran for AMS president last spring. He came in second place. He's also spent years pushing the AMS to establish an Indigenous committee, and the committee is rolling out this winter. So here, first is the tape by Rodney and Laura.
All right, how about each of you just introduce yourselves first?
I'm Laura. I am Métis Cree. I'm from Gruard, Alberta.
Okay, Nisukawat Nistu Mr. Wastan, Pekani Nistatapi. I'm Rodney Little Mustache from the Pekani Nation in southern Alberta.
And so we're here to talk about, especially about the Indigenous Committee that you guys are helping spearhead over at AMS. So, yeah, maybe start with how it came to be, how you got involved with this project, Rodney.
Okay. I had a lot of things written down, but I'll just tell you right from memory. Okay. A few years ago, I was with a friend. I just accidentally walked into the old student union building, and there was a discussion, and I asked a friend of mine, Tracy. She was the orientation dorm leader, I think what you call her, Tracy B. And she encouraged me to speak up, and because I wasn't sure if I could ask a question. And then I asked, where are all the Indigenous students? Where are they? Like, why aren't they here? They couldn't answer that. So after that, I started from 4 years ago till last year. I went out and I started talking to Indigenous students and like getting to know them and like introducing myself, engaging with them. I talked to them about what was missing within the AMS for them. And a lot of them had issues that they didn't feel welcome here. And they didn't bother coming around here because who was on there speaking for them? then I decided to get involved. So I got involved with one of the committees, the external committee, and then that's where I started working on getting these issues addressed about indigenous representation within the AMS. After that, I decided to run for the election. It was just a spur-of-the-moment decision. I said, hey, okay, I'll run. And then that's when I realized how hard it was to work through the those cliques that they have here and being able to be who you are. And it was just like, it was a very difficult process with them. They had all these rules and regulations that were new to me because it feels like you can't question them or work through them unless they want to. And it's more or less like what people, Native First Nations and Indigenous people go through in Canada with the governments that are in place right now. And a lot of people say I get too political, but I've been doing this sort of thing all my life. Like at the Indigenous Circle, we had it a couple of months ago, Elder Larry Grant told me, you more than anybody should speak up about inclusion because I'm HIV positive for so many years. And when I think about that, it's true. And like a lot of times I've had to fight like for First Nations to be, or Indigenous people to be heard, and for a person living with HIV, for our voices to be heard when policy is given to us and we have to live with that policy and it doesn't work for us. So we have to speak up against it. The other thing too about being two-spirit is like recognition. And so on so many fronts, I'm fighting for recognition. And that's how I think it all got started. It was like that drive and like the people in my life, the elders in my life, my family, they all encouraged me to keep going forward. But at times I may make mistakes, but they said people make mistakes along the way, but just keep going after that. And that's what got me started with this Indigenous committee. I felt that it was time for the AMS and UBC to start addressing our issues as students, because when you look around here, there's nothing that's Indigenous within this building here. You see the Thunderbird, and that's a symbol of the Coast Salish people, but that's about it. And there's no like stores here for us. I'd love to see a Bannock store, Indian Taco Day, something like that. Holy, but it's very difficult to feel welcome here when you don't see nothing that's welcoming you here.
I think UBC is really good at pretending that they represent Indigenous people with all of the clan poles and the Indigenous art around campus. But when it comes down to it, there is no support for Indigenous students. There's nothing. I advocated for a room in the nest and we got it, which is amazing. But why did I have to ask for it? Why aren't there other spaces on campus available for us besides the Longhouse?
And the one thing, too, is like after 151 years, there was no Indigenous representation here. And you have to really think about that. It's like they talk about reconciliation, but when you look at their system here, there's nothing really set up. I really don't like doing it, but I have to do it. It's like you're forced to do it. You have to follow a colonizer's rules in order to get anywhere here, in order to get things done. We have to go by their rules, even though this is unceded territory. We have to go by their rules here. And it's like a friend of mine told me, you can't do that. You have to go by their rules. I said, why? He said, because it won't get done if you don't follow the rules. So, well, these rules aren't ours. It's not the rules of the land, but we are forced to do it, not just here in BC, but across Canada. First Nations and Indigenous people are forced to use rules that are not their own. And look at the governments right now. We're forced to go by their rules. And look what those rules are doing to us. A lot of people right now, it bothers me. And it comes from universities. They should be starting to teach people that we had rules too before they got here. We had systems of governments. We had our own education system. We had structures in place, but then they were taken away and we had to live by other people's rules. And now we still have to live by those rules. But one of the things I see on TV when you watch those CPAC. Yes, I watch CPAC. And hey, to be honest, I watch Margaret Thatcher videos on YouTube. I do. I know for some reason I like that woman's strength. I don't like her policies, but I love her strength. Anyway, I see those parliamentarians. They tell the general public, we have to respect that house. okay? But when you look at them on TV, you see all those politicians yelling at the other person, banging on the table. How is that respect? And, like, they're telling us to respect that. And it's just, it bothers me. There's different, like, they really contradict themselves when they speak to the public.
Yeah. So maybe you guys could both talk about how you're hoping this committee will be different and, like, what you're hoping to be able to do.
I just hope it lasts beyond Rodney. Like, Rodney is probably graduating soon, and...
Oh, no.
No? Okay. Rodney's not graduating soon, so the committee will last a long time. But I just hope that there's more students like me and Rodney who are willing to put the work behind this committee, because there's so much work that needs to be done. And I think the scope of this committee is much larger than we think it is. I was just discussing that last night with another committee member.
When I started this whole thing, I went for a walk and I started thinking about what I'm going to do. And it's hard at times because I had my own problems I'm trying to deal with, but then I stopped looking at myself and I started thinking, wait, hang on, there's other people involved here, and there's a lot more people involved here. I realized that it's time to start working for the youth that belong here. There are so many youth out there that belong here. They had years of struggles. They saw their elders go through a lot of problems, and they're strong enough, they can speak up, but they're not here. They're not here because of the admission policies or funding. And it's for them that I do this. Thanks. And I'm glad to meet Laura and the people that are within that committee, Cavalina, Russell and Kaz and how do you say her name? Yao.
Faruka,
yeah. All of them. It seems like they're committed to this. I'm glad they are, because it shows that they're not doing it for themselves. They're doing it for the youth that should be here. I think the president and the president of the AMS as well, they should work hard to get more Indigenous students here. I'm thinking of putting a referendum forward about making 2019 and 2020 the year of the Indigenous student. And if you ask why, I said, well, think of it. You look around here, there's hardly any Indigenous students, like 3% out of 75,000 people. That's crazy. It's on unceded territory. Where are all the Indigenous students? There should be more Indigenous students. It's called oppression if you don't allow the people to be educated on their own land. Mm-hmm. And knowledge is free, so why not give them free education here? Not just them, the low-income people that should belong here. There's a lot of changes that I could see here that should be worked on. And getting the first step is getting a lot more Indigenous students here. When I ran for that, sat on one of the committees, one of the committee members asked me, how do we engage First Nations or Indigenous students? I said, well, solve the problem before that, which is getting the students here. And I think that's what the UBC has to work on right away.
Do you have anything to add?
I forgot what I was going to say. I think I was going to talk about representation.
Yes.
Especially in terms of the Indian Residential School Dialogue and Education Center. It's like there's nothing in it. And we had this huge ceremony this summer, and it was really beautiful. I watched it online. It was really moving. And then I learned now that there's no documents in it. So why did they build without having anything set up? They said they're, like, having trouble getting documents. But why wasn't that figured out before you did this big opening ceremony? And it's such, I'm really learning now to take anything that UBC does in terms of Indigenous representation at face value, because there's usually nothing behind it. Yeah, we broke down Santa Ono's apology to Indigenous people in one of my classes, and it was brutal because everyone was like, this is not true. This has not happened. What is he talking about? And at one point he even said, instead of LGBTQ plus, he said LGBTQ, like, addition, like some weird thing that, like, he'd never had said LGBTQ plus before in his life. Like, he's very,
like,
uninformed. It's clear someone else wrote it, because it's not very meaningful.
Okay.
So Rodney, Laura, and Kaz have put a lot of time into launching the Indigenous Committee. Kaz, what have those first few meetings been like?
Yeah, the first few meetings are just getting things off the ground. The very first order of business that we unanimously passed was electing Rodney as the president of the Indigenous Committee. So he's put in a lot of the work there. And then beyond that, we had to get our terms of reference in line, which has been a bit of a process because everyone has a differing opinion about what our terms of reference should be. And because once those are finalized, they're kind of cemented, they have to get approved and put through the AMS. And we weren't actually an official committee until we got that done. So it actually took us close to four meetings to get our terms of reference finalized. And then once we did, we got them put through to the AMS, who approved them. And then we got official status, which was nice. When a bunch of us went and attended one of the official AMS meetings where we were unanimously voted in and given the official status. So that was a big moment for us, getting this official status as a committee. And so it's just been about getting it off the ground and seeing who's interested, seeing who's committed as well, because with each meeting, you know, we had a lot of people turn up to the first one, and then it's kind of slowed down since then. So just seeing who's actually interested in bringing about the real change.
The committee will be getting a space here in the Nest. What is that space like?
So when we first brought the committee to the Nest, they had set aside a few options for us. There were three different options in the Nest that we looked at. And ultimately, we decided in a space on the third floor, right next to the gaming lounge. It faces north, and it's really nice because it's a bright space. It's got a fair amount of space. You can kind of get a bit of a view. But beyond that, it also is accessible for us to smudge in, which is one of the deciding factors that made us choose that space. Mm-hmm. So it's great. You know, right now it's unfurnished, it's raw, and we're just trying to figure out how we want to move forward with it. The AMS has set aside a fair budget for us to get some furniture. We're trying to source maybe some used furniture and just decide how we want to get set up. We're going to be having an official opening in January for it.
How do you think it will be set up?
That depends.
Do you have any ideas?
Everyone has ideas, and they're all different.
Are there any favorite ideas?
Beanbag chairs.
Yeah.
Yeah, we've got a consensus on that one, at least. Other than that, I mean, another thing that kind of motivated our choice is that room had a large TV in it.
Okay.
So we want to have kind of an area where people can be comfortable and just socialize. But then beyond that, we also want to have an area for focus and study. Mm-hmm. We want it to feel like it's both a place to relax and congregate, but also a place of focus that shows a bit of a prestige and elevation to what we want to put forward as our energy and message, right?
That makes sense. I mean, for me personally, the only space that I really feel comfortable in the Nest is CITR, and it's like not Indigenous really at all, except for Steph and I.
Yeah, well, I mean,
But I think that it'll be really nice to have a space like that in the Nest.
I hope so. And I was kind of thinking about it because we don't have a lot of Indigenous representation. But then the irony is that with all these different Indigenous people coming together, we don't want to get overrepresentation of one man's tradition. So we have to kind of keep it general as well. So there's a lot of consideration that goes into it. Mm-hmm. We're just trying to figure that out right now because it does have a nice floor-to-ceiling glass wall near the entrance. And so we're going to do some frosted designs on there. And so we're still trying to figure out how we want to move forward with that. But I think it should look pretty good once we get it done.
Are you going to commission art to go in it or like buy art or anything?
We haven't decided yet.
Okay.
Yeah.
I think it's a good idea.
Yeah.
One thing that you said earlier, I'd love to hear you talk about more, is about like the actual placement of the room and the placement of like the Longhouse and other Indigenous spaces. Can you talk a bit more about that?
Sure. I can't take credit for that idea. Yeah. Laura Beaudry was the person who first told me about that, and it really got me thinking. But in terms of Indigenous spaces on campus, like the Longhouse and the residential school building that they put, they're all kind of below ground. They're low in terms of where they stand. And I mean, maybe there's symbolism to that, maybe there isn't, but the fact is this is the first space that we have where we have an elevated above ground space for Indigenous people to come together. And that kind of feels good in the sense that we're being put, this is a committee that is technically equal but separate from the AMS. And so for us to have a standing above in the Nest, which is the big student union building, there's a lot of representation significance with that for us. So this space is a big change. Mm-hmm.
I'm kind of curious about how people can get involved with this if they're interested.
Yeah, I mean, right now I feel like a lot of the word about this committee hasn't gotten out. It is very much still in the early stages. Once we have our opening in January, we are extending an open invitation. We do want more people to be involved. It's very much not a closed group. Anyone that wants to be there and have their voice heard as an Indigenous member of the UBC community, please come out. You have to attend at least 4 meetings before you'll have voting powers. But if you have a real commitment to representation, anyone is welcome to come out. And we want to spread it through word of mouth, through social media. Any way to get the word out about this committee, we will take it.
So, like, what would be the best way for someone to come see? Like, do they come to this specific location, or should they, like, write you an email?
Either or. I think getting in touch with us will help, but attending an official meeting is definitely one of the most important steps. So we do have an email chain. So if you contact us, you could probably get to us through the AMS or through, we're going to launch our social media group in January as well, so you can contact us that way. And then we will happily sign you onto our email list, let you know when our meetings are, and you can just come check it out.
I have a question about Indigenous engagement. I'm wondering if the only way to get involved is to, like, join this club, and if you're going to be having, like, other, like, external events, like movie nights with the big TV and the beanbag chairs, or, like, like late night, like, study things, or just, like, events for students to maybe, like, feel welcome and comfortable in the space.
Yeah, that's very much not limited to the Indigenous Committee. I think the Indigenous Committee is about bringing about representation in terms of politics on campus, right? But the Longhouse, they host events. We've got our Indigenous lunches every Tuesday afternoon from 12:30 to 2. I've never been able to attend one because I always have class. but I hear they're great. and then we did a movie night earlier this year. We watched Smoke Signals, which was great. There are events. There's the Indigenous Leadership Collective, which is a separate entity from the Indigenous Committee. And that one is open invitation as well. It's run through the Faculty of Arts. So anyone is welcome to join that. I'd recommend talking to their arts advisory people. We have Indigenous counselors. So they would be able to put them in touch with the people, including myself, who can help them get more involved. But we did the Day of the Longboat this year, right? So we had a lot of Indigenous people show up for that. And we do try to have these inclusive events where people can just get together, share food, and feel welcome.
That's great. And then we're wondering what you would like to see come from the committee.
A lot. We have a fair bit. One of the big things that we're looking at next year is they've set aside a budget for us to have a powwow.
Oh, wow.
Yeah. Nice. So that's going to be a big deal. But that's not happening until probably September of next year. And that gives us a lot of time to get people involved and see how we can establish our standing. We're going to have a voice on the AMS Council. There's a position opening up that people are open to apply to. I'm going to be applying for it. And that person will be the liaison between the Indigenous Committee and the AMS directly. So, like, what we want to see is Indigenous people have a voice. Because previously they have not been represented on the AMS at all. And that's something that Rodney has been really passionate about pushing forward and advancing. I don't know what type of, like, specific goals we want to have, because we're just starting this out. We don't really know what direction we want to go in, but we want Indigenous people to feel like they have a voice here on campus. That's the most important thing, is just to not feel marginalized.
Thank you so much for being here, Kaz.
Yeah, my pleasure. Thanks for having me.
Conversation. Yeah.
Through the Amplify BC Career Development Program, Creative BC offers grants for musicians and bands across British Columbia. This program supports sound recording, music videos, and marketing initiatives for all genres. You can apply for the grant from now until December 12th. To learn more, join us for an info session and visit creativebc.com and get your applications in today.
Of CITR and Discorder, but are you a true friend?
Get a Friends of CITR and Discorder card for $20 for discounts on Main Street at
Antisocial Skateboard Shop, Biltmore Cabaret, Red Cat Records, Lucky Comics, The Wallflower Modern Diner, Neptune Records, The Rag Machine, The Regional Assembly of Text, and so many more.
Your true friend,
You're listening to Unceded Airwaves on CITR 101.9 FM. We just heard Rodney Little Mustache, Laura Beaudry, and Kaz Tebeji. Nope, I got it wrong. Sorry. talking about Indigenous representation here at UBC.
Rodney and Laura are also both anthropology majors, and we talked about what it's like for them to take on a discipline with such a problematic and colonial history. So here's just a bit of that conversation.
I'm sitting there and I'm listening to a lot of these lectures, and a lot of them they don't go in depth into it. Eh? They just say one thing and that's it. They have one article through the whole thing about Indigenous people.
Yeah.
They're using European what do you call
theorists?
Theorists, yeah.
Yeah.
And they're
that's
not
what I was just saying.
They're not talking about one of the things I'm addressing in one of the papers I'm doing tonight is that spirituality. They talk very little about spirituality. And one day I was looking at doing some research, looking at these videos, and there's these Hopi Indians. My cousin calls them Hopi Indians. And, we were watching it, and it freaked me out because I got goosebumps. Just, they're doing a traditional ceremony, and this guy's singing. There's these people just all sitting in a circle. They're singing. His daughter dances. His medicine man's daughter is dancing. And she's dancing to the east, to all the four directions. They put this. They did a painting, like a sand painting, on the ground, and then they covered it with a little blanket, and then they placed four feathers on there. When they started singing, those feathers all stood up and started dancing.
What?
I'll show you that video later. It freaked me out when I saw it, eh? Gosh. And it was just late at night. I watched it. I said, what? And you go through all those videos, and they're old. They're archived videos. Mm. I don't understand why they're not talking about those when it comes to Indigenous people.
I think in anthropology, they focus on ritual. They talk about, like, the old savage Indian and ritual magic. They don't understand that it's still a part of people's lives, and it's not ritual magic. It's very deeply personal and spiritual.
Mm-hmm.
Yeah. They don't understand that.
And like you were saying, like, yeah, but anthropology has framed it that way for, like, centuries. So
beginning.
Just,
since the beginning. And anthropology was created by, like, old white men.
Yeah.
And so what I do in, like, all of my papers, and I'm sure Rodney does too, I try to decolonize and try not to reference these old white men because their theories are no longer relevant, and they probably wouldn't feel the same way if they were alive today.
Yeah, really. Yeah.
So I like to focus on contemporary Indigenous anthropologists or theorists even, and, like, bring it into anthropology and, like, just tear it down, restructure it.
One of the things that I'm taking that, what did you call it again? The collapse of civilizations. And when you sit back and look at the whole world, you'll notice that the European, their systems collapsed. The Romans collapsed. The Greeks collapsed. The Western civilization, Trump is making that collapse right now. He's starting that collapse right now with what he's doing.
I think the British Empire didn't collapse because they came here instead. And they were able to expand into places like North America and India and all these places. I think that's the only reason why it didn't collapse, because people were dying from the bubonic plague, so they had to leave. Like, they lived so disgustingly, they had to leave their country. That's how bad it was.
Yeah.
Yeah.
So when you sit back and you see all these systems around the world collapsing, you'll notice that the Indigenous people on Turtle Island and other places, they're surviving. There's recently in the news, there's missionary. He went to an island and he got killed. Mm-hmm. And when I saw that, deep down I felt right on, but again,
it's a half human of me. Being, right?
Yeah, it's a
that's
human
a,
being.
That was my struggle too.
Yeah.
He's doing a bad thing, but he's also a human being.
Yeah, if people wanted to learn about Jesus and God, they'd ask to learn about it. Mm-hmm. These people, they were left alone. They were only found after that tsunami. Mm-hmm. They were there alone. And for him to do that and for other people to do that, and now they're making a big stink about it, what's going on. If they returned his body, that'd be great. But they have to do it respectfully and follow their traditions. They can't force European or other people's traditions on them.
Mm-hmm. For them to be like, we need his body back, is like, no, he said no. Leave me there, because he knew the dangers that could come from it. Mm-hmm. But also, he's dumb. For keep going back, like, they tried to kill him three times.
It's not just anthropology courses, it's other courses here. they do a lot of discussion, but they don't really discuss the indigenous peoples here. And the way that we did, like, time, just for science, like, time was a new concept for us. My cousin was telling me about this. And if you watch Big Thinking by Leroy Littlebear, if you find it on YouTube, he talks about the concept of time, how it was different for us. I was sitting there writing what he was saying, word for word. What he was saying on that video is everything that people were telling me when I was growing up, like from a child up until now, it all came back, and all those traditions were starting to come back. And it can be difficult at times because, for me personally, it was difficult this past term. Things were happened in my childhood that I'm starting to deal with right now. And then having to sit in those classes and being triggered almost every day about what's going on. And then having to, like, come up with an excuse or something to your professor and those in charge. It can be difficult. And not being able to get out of my bed for a week was really hard for me. It came from the triggers that I was receiving here.
I think in anthropology, it's still hard for teachers to confront their privilege in how they teach and how they learn. I see it sometimes when they talk about Indigenous stuff, there's some uncomfortableness in certain teachers. And so I think they're still learning how to confront that for themselves. But when you're talking about trauma in the classroom, I've definitely felt tears coming in the classroom. And I think a lot of teachers are not aware that that stuff is really harsh for us to talk about and think about. And, you know, in the beginning of the class when they say, if anyone's uncomfortable, just leave. But you don't want to be that one who leaves and, like, goes out and sits in the hallway by themselves. Like, that's even more traumatizing. Yeah. And so I think teachers need to be really careful about what they're teaching and who is in the classroom when they're teaching it. Because there's some shit that I've gone through in the classroom by myself. And just, like, had to breathe through it. And, like, okay, don't look at anyone. Just, like, do this, you know, put your head down and pretend you're just, like, closing your eyes. So that's where I learned about residential schools and anthropology and governments coming in and, like, doing all this work to, like, save the Indian, right? And so it is difficult being Indigenous in this field because of the past. But I want to, like, be part of the solution that, you know, reframes it, restructures it.
Student in the studio, master's student, Karen Thomas. I'm wondering, Karen, if anything jumped out to you about with Rodney and Laura's conversation.
Oh, all of it. All of it was completely relevant. I don't know. I did my undergrad at a university where archaeology was separate from anthropology. So, like, in terms of choosing anthropology, I don't think I chose anthropology. I've been joking, calling myself the reluctant anthropologist, which is, like, a take to this criticism of the discipline from, like, an anti-colonial criticism of the discipline, but all of it, being triggered by everything. I think starting my university career in archaeology allowed me to ignore a lot of the colonial existence of anthropology because the archaeology department at the university I did my undergrad is so progressive, and they have all sorts of relationships and partnerships with dissent communities, and they're really, like, true allies in the field. And I think coming here to UBC and being immersed in, like, a department where people still study the other, essentially, was, like, a shock for me. I'm still sort of like, I agree, going to class and listening to the dialogue, the discourses of anthropology is really traumatizing, for sure.
And you said that you're writing, like, a paper on this topic at the moment, right?
Yeah, I'm working on a paper on decolonizing anthropology, which has been this emotional work for me. And basically just, like, I think decolonizing the academy is important, but especially anthropology. And you mentioned something earlier, Autumn, about, like just theories being, like, out
irrelevant. They're past their relevance. But I think one of the things I've had a hard time coming to terms with is the fact that there are people who still ascribe to these ancient theories, and they really like hold fast to them, and they're not ready for transformation in the discipline. And that's hard too, because I mean, so much of this language we're told to situate the author in their time when they're using words like savage and primitive, mm-hmm. and there are still people who ascribe to these theories, and that's hard, I guess.
I'm just trying to like navigate that, and
yeah,
learn how to exist within that, while also not like aiming to not exist within that.
Well, and then. Laura said something about citing contemporary Indigenous anthropologists, which I think is a thing that I do. I lean heavily on Indigenous scholarship as self-care, because it's tough. Like, you know, writing a paper on like settler colonialism, for example, there's tons of Indigenous scholarship that you can draw upon, but you also have to like paint the picture of the structure, and to do that you're drawing upon all the stuffy old white guys of the discipline, and that's hard. I mean, yeah, and I think it's part of it is accepting the absurdity of Indigenous people in the academy. Like, they never it's absurd. They just I guess the olden time scholars never would have imagined it, right?
And also, like, thinking about how if you're, like, drawing upon or, like, describing a framework, you don't really have any Indigenous literature to draw from that's, like, historical, because it's all white people writing things about us instead of, like, a form of self-representation within that. So it's hard to, like, write historical papers or, like, use historical theories and then...
Yeah. No, that's tough. I mean, I think that archaeology is different. I've been blessed to work on collaborative projects between First Nations and passionate archaeologists who are committed to like community-driven research, which, I mean, there are some anthropologists doing that, and I don't know a lot of them, but I mean, like, they are doing good things, and I don't want to paint the entire discipline with like a terrible tarnish, yeah. But it's tough. I've said that a couple times now. I think that's the point I'm trying to convey.
No, I think it is. And I definitely, like, understand that a lot. Like, going into this, I wanted to study, like, gender studies. But I ended up in First Nations and Indigenous studies because it's one of the only disciplines where I can, like, cite contemporary Indigenous authors and, like, have choices within that. Like, I'm not stuck to citing three of them and writing the same three papers for the rest of my degree, which I know is something that, like, I've talked to Laura about, where it's hard because you end up writing the same thing over and over again. Because you're trying to, like, hold up these amazing authors and, like, writers and scholars that are doing amazing work in this field, but there's just, like, it's so few and far between.
It's true. I do appreciate the First Nations and Indigenous Studies department here. I've only taken a couple of classes, but that's where all of my electives have been from.
Yeah.
So, I mean, there are ways of coping, I guess. I think that the conclusion I reached from writing this emotional paper is that, like, I'm the best tool for decolonizing the discipline. It's infiltration and it's representation, and it's all of these themes that are common all across every university everywhere, right?
I commend you for doing that. Thank you so much for doing that.
We'll see when I'm done.
Taking that space.
Do you think, like, are you going to become one of the few Indigenous anthropologists future
students
one of can
them.
Reference? Or like, where do you want to go from, like, what you learn here?
Well, originally, I was quite committed to becoming a professor because when I wanted to do graduate studies, the people I was looking at to study with were, like, Sonia Adelaide and Dorothy Lippert, who are both archaeologists, but they work at institutions on the Eastern Seaboard in the United States, and I want to become a professor in an academy somewhere so that local kids don't have to travel that far to study with brilliant Indigenous women scholars who are doing good things in archaeology. And now I'm not so sure about a PhD. We'll see if I survive. No. I think that when I graduate, I'm going to spend some time working for my nation, the Saulteaux Nation, either in referrals or as an archaeologist, and just remember what it was I was hoping to achieve when I started this academic journey. But, yeah.
Yeah.
Do you have a topic for your thesis, I'm wondering?
Well, that's a long story. No. I came here with the intent of studying ochre, which is a mineral pigment with a great historical and contemporary significance. And my plan was to do like an ethnographic and a geochemical analysis of ochre use to show continuity of ritual, to use anthropological terms. But basically, I wanted to talk to local Coast Salish nations about their uses of ochre to determine if there were individual ritual properties based on like the type of ochre. Like, so ochre A is used for this and ochre B is used for that. And then I wanted to use like swanky technology, like X-ray fluorescence to geochemically fingerprint the ochres and see if I could map those uses onto the arc record by using previously excavated materials. And now I'm not so sure because my time is dwindling and to talk to living people, you have to do like a BREB review, like research ethics. I had some trauma with a research ethics review for my undergrad thesis. And just basically like, I'm not sure that I want to do that in archaeology. I don't know. It's up in the air. That's what I'd like to do. I mean, I think that ochre is beautiful and anything I do for my thesis. And if I do a PhD, like I want to challenge these discourses of anthropology. There are still anthropologists that believe that indigenous cultures ended at contact and that we can't evolve and we can't be resilient. Amanda and I just had this conversation yesterday about like resiliency versus resurgency and like the problematic words that are used when talking about, I don't know, things.
Mm-hmm. Can you talk a bit more about that?
I don't know, Amanda, do you want to talk about your research?
For my thesis, I'm looking at an exhibit at MOA. We'll see what happens after I write it. But the plan is to think about how museums can be more welcoming spaces, how people who have been historically alienated from these spaces, how we can think about exhibits differently, and how we can design them differently so that they aren't as alienating. So we were having a conversation about...
Amanda bought me lunch. And then I did an interview.
Reparations!
You know, no, you share food, right?
Yeah, of course.
It's true. She did her research. I mean, no. It was basically I went and I spent some time sitting with the objects in a curated exhibit, and then we just had like a discussion about my feelings, and one of the things that I really appreciated about the exhibit was that it conveys this resiliency, like a continuity of culture instead of the dialogue that's quite often used of like language revitalization, and not that there's anything wrong with those people doing that work, revitalization suggests that something needed to be revitalized, and I think that resiliency just speaks to the ongoing, the existence. Things like resurgency is like, oh, it's coming back now, but it didn't really go anywhere. You just weren't paying attention, I think.
That's something that Sarah DuPont speaks to a lot in First Nations and Endangered Languages. She gave a talk that I was at in May about like language revitalization and how it just like insinuates that something was dead when it was never dead. It was always there. Mm-hmm. It just took a nap. It was sleeping. And I think that that's a really beautiful way to talk about it. Yeah.
Yeah.
And I want to attribute the person who did this tweet, but I can't remember who did it, but someone did a similar tweet that really stuck with me too, saying like, let's stop talking about dying languages, let's start talking about languages that like people tried to kill, mm-hmm. you know, like it wasn't like they just started to die.
Yeah, no, I think being mindful of the language we use and the discourses we perpetuate are super important, especially in anthropology.
I'm curious, you're saying that coming to UBC or to the master's program, you were surprised by how it wasn't as progressive. But did I get that correct?
That's what I was insinuating. I was going to use that language. I think that late in my undergrad, I chose to do an anthropology minor because all of my friends who had come to UBC to do their graduate studies had said that the anthropology-archaeology divide at Simon Fraser really sets you up to be behind when you come here to study archaeology. So I was like, I'll do a minor. And then it was really hard for me there. But I think that separation allowed me to really kind of demonize the discipline, and I've, in my paper I call it colonial angst. So I directed all of this colonial angst at anthropology, and then choosing to come here to do my grad studies is like I've had to confront it, and it's been this, it's like almost comical. My friends just I think I'm hilarious, like people from my cohort in undergrad, and they're like doing great archaeology things, playing in the dirt, and I'm like banging my head against these colonial theories, and it's like I too could be playing in the dirt right now. But
how do you think you cope through that, or self-care through that?
Damage. I mentioned before we started the show, I have two small children. And I think that, like, aside from self-care, I don't get a lot of self-care. Self-care is sleep and showering. but, like, I think to the future and how I have, like, a reason for doing this. I'm normalizing post-secondary education. I'm being a person, like, not even just for my kids, but for my community. Like, mm-hmm. It's a thing that you do. Mm-hmm. I'm one of the first people from my community to do graduate studies. The education department didn't know a lot about, like, the structure of graduate studies prior to me being here. And I'm grateful for the opportunity to teach them about that to make it easier for whoever wants to do graduate work next. So, like, I guess self-care is just envisioning a utopia. No. The future, I guess. Yeah. I don't know.
Self-care is hard.
Yeah.
Yeah.
Did I sound, am I come across as jaded? I don't want to discourage people from studying. Dorothy Lipper, she's a Choctaw bioarchaeologist who works at the Smithsonian in the repatriation department. She speaks about it's really hard to invite people into archaeology when, like, the bones of your ancestors are in cardboard boxes in the hallway. Mm-hmm. Like, that's a difficult, it's not enticing. Like, come study archaeology. I think that change makers are coming. I might not be a change maker, but, you know, hope to inspire one.
I think you are a change maker. Yeah.
Yeah.
So that's about all we have time for right now, but thank you so much for being here.
Well, it was a great honor to be here. Thank you.
The BC government now covers medications that could reduce your chances of contracting HIV by 90%. PREP stands for pre-exposure prophylaxis and is a preventative measure that HIV-negative folks can take to reduce their risk of becoming positive. Health Initiative for Men suggests that if you have had sex with a partner with HIV, have had a recent STI, have multiple sexual partners, have a history of inconsistent or no condom use, are currently involved in sex work, or have had repeated courses of post-exposure prophylaxis, then you might want to think about looking into PREP measures. CATR and Discorder are not medical professionals. Please refer to your doctor for more information.
MRG Concerts presents John Grant. He's got pills, motherships. He thinks he's going downtown, and now he's smacking his lips. The singer, songwriter, and synth lover returns to Vancouver in support of his fourth solo album, Love is Magic. This is his best and most electronic record yet. Catch him live at the Imperial on December 20th. Tickets on sale now at Ticketfly and Red Cat Records.
So these are kind of different topics, but the kind of common thing, it seems, through what Rodney said and what both of you have shared with us is about representation and existing in a very colonial structure, but trying to decolonize it. And that's such an incredibly difficult thing to do. Like, it's literally when you're starting from, like, step one. So I guess that's something I'd like to ask a little bit more about. Like, do you feel kind of like how Rodney said, you feel to, I guess, to toe the line and follow these rules in order to get anything done? Or do you have, like, a just, like, smash at it kind of mentality?
I wish there was a four-step formula to decolonizing.
Wiki answers, everybody.
Well, my reluctance to maybe do a PhD, I have no idea where I stand on the PhD topic, but it's like, this is a colonial yardstick. I want the letters after my name for the respect. I want to be Dr. Karen Rose Thomas because people will take me more seriously. Mm-hmm. Or like I spent a lot of the last year examining my motivation for even wanting to do graduate work. Mm-hmm. And so on the one hand, I want to infiltrate and change. And on the other, like, I'm just part of the academic industrial complex, so.
And on the other, you just kind of want to play in the dirt.
Yeah!
There's no winning.
Yeah. Play with my babies in the dirt. No.
This sounds dreamy.
Yeah. And, like, Kaz, like, thinking about politics, like, is there a way that you, I don't know, are envisioning that this committee could operate differently, like, in a literally, like, a different kind of format than, like, the AMS, for example, does?
Yeah, sure. I mean, first, I just want to say it's hilarious that you say Rodney toes the line. Like, he's trying to light the line on fire.
But pressure to toe the line, okay. And then he doesn't.
Yeah, no, I mean, he's pushing back in a major way. And that's great because it gives us all, it inspires us all to feel like we can do that as well, right? Like, we can be agents of change. So I think the first step is getting our voice on the AMS Council, which we're going to be doing by hiring this AMS liaison person. And then once we get a feel for what it's like to be represented, then we can try and expand it, right? Like Rodney ran last year. I think we want to look at getting Indigenous people more directly involved with politics on campus through the normal channels, through running elections and campaigns and just realizing that it's okay for us to put ourselves out there. Win or lose, we just want people to understand that they can be empowered. And that's part of what the Indigenous Committee is about.
I actually want to turn the tables on Jamuna. Well, just about talking once again, existing within these systems, both of us are in journalism school, and we talked a lot about kind of representation in media, once again, that has like a bit of a complicated history and pretty limited Indigenous faculty. We're very lucky to have Duncan McHugh teach a reporting in Indigenous communities class, and sometimes to have Candace Collison, though she's away right now. But yeah, like kind of, what have you gone through with these kind of conversations?
These kinds of conversations about...
Like about representation, I guess. Like, do you feel a pressure, especially in media?
Right. I guess the biggest thing that I think about, and I've been thinking about more since I've come to school, is something that actually Candace brought up in class last year, just about, you know, thinking about, are people... She talks of her own example of being approached by people simply because she's Indigenous, mm-hmm. not because of her specialty or the area of expertise that she carries, but because she's an Indigenous person. And for some reason, that makes her qualified for whatever it is that people are looking for. And so that's made me reflect a lot on, you know, just like how different, how much diversity there is within the Indigenous community and how that gets missed a lot by people that are well-meaning, but just not really thinking in that way. And just even catching myself when I do that too, you know, it's all about like my own self-reflection all the time. And so, yeah, that's a big thing that I'm kind of developing is just a respect for, you know, like the Coast Salish peoples and how different that is from where I come from on the plains and just like the way that I think about things. And I'm not going to assume that I know anything about the people here because I don't, you know, and I'm trying to be here in a respectful way and learn just as I feel like anyone, and maybe I do come with my own sense of respect, but other than that, I am a student when it comes to like Indigenous spaces over here.
I have a question just for Jamuna and Steph, I guess. But Laura Beaudry and I were talking a little while ago about She told me that she Googled Indigenous women for one of her assignments, and it was about, like, she was scrolling through 8 pages to find something positive about Indigenous women. Like, the rest of the first 8 pages were about, like, the deaths of Indigenous women. And I'm kind of wondering how, like, as journalism students and as journalists, you kind of navigate those, and, like, not so much from navigate those spaces, I guess, not so much from a deficit model, but, like, thinking about, like, self-representation and, like, how you tackle these journalism endeavors.
Do I go start?
Yeah, 100%. It's super difficult because you want to counteract all of that coverage. You want to give a balance and more complexity and nuance to the coverage of Indigenous peoples, and especially women, not as just, like, dead or dying or in danger or putting themselves in danger. At the same time, a lot of the rules of journalism are not necessarily in the interest of, like, Indigenous peoples. So, for example, when you try to pitch a positive story, a lot of the time you will hear someone say, like, oh, but how is this not just a PR story for this person or for this organization? And and sometimes you have the energy, sometimes you don't, to try to explain, like, well, actually, like, we need these stories too, and these stories are just as important.
Otherwise we feel like we're dying.
Yeah, and I think a really big part of how I am thinking about, you know, just decolonizing journalism, what does that mean, and how does that play out in my own practice? Mm-hmm. And I think a big thing that comes up is that, like, I can't really share, or I can't tell anyone else's story.
Yeah.
Like everyone has to have that opportunity to share their own stories, and I can be maybe a vessel for that story to reach an audience, or, you know, somehow help someone refine their story so that other people can receive it and hear it. And I think that when it comes to the story of missing women, that care really needs to be taken to have families share the stories in their own way, and you know, just to be kind of coming in without those preconceived ideas of how these stories should go.
Yeah.
And yeah.
It's also just, like, really hard because we need to talk about missing and murdered Indigenous women, but it's hard when that's all we're hearing, you know? Mm-hmm. And, like, I don't know, I think that a lot in, like, my own practice, I had the job that Steph had last year, but, like, just in my own practice of, like, media storytelling, it's just, like, trying to tell these stories from, this is just my own personal struggle, but trying to tell these stories from, like, or balance these stories from, like, sharing the facts and, like, the necessities of this, but also with, like, trying to inspire young Indigenous women and tell them that, like, they're not going to be dead by age 30, because that's what we're fed a lot of the time.
Mm-hmm. Yeah, I think all of us kind of want, like, the studio to be, like, a really positive space we're in it, and, like, we're inhabiting it. And that was the biggest compliment when Kim Harvey said that she felt that way afterwards. Like, that was the best, because, yeah, we want to cover these hard stories, but we really want, like, everyone's experience here to be, like, empowering and positive too. Mm-hmm.
Does anybody have anything else that they would like to say? Our time in the studio is unfortunately running out. We can't just inhabit this forever. Although I wish we could.
Should we get into the...
Yes. So I guess that about does it for today's show. So thank you, Kaz and Karen, for talking about representation with us today. And also thank you to Jamuna and Steph and Amanda for all speaking about representation, like, Indigenous spaces.
Thanks for tuning into Unseated Airwaves. Tweet us or find us on Facebook at Unseated Airwaves with your thoughts and show ideas. You can find this episode and others at citr.ca.
Also, make sure to check out the Waseem Gathering Light Music and Art Fundraiser tonight at the Wise Hall in East Vancouver. You can see Murray Potter, Snotty Nose Res Kids, JB the First Lady, DJ Osho, Kin Balam, DJ Kukum, as well as powwow dancers and Métis jiggers.
Money raised will go to Dancer Strong Earth Woman, or Madeline McCallum. The proceeds will help with her cancer recovery and her documentary project about her life, which is called Dancing Through.
If you'd like to volunteer with us, tweet us at Unseated Airwaves or email volunteer@citr.ca.
Tune in for our next show on December 19th. This is Unseated Airwaves on CITR 101.9 FM. Marcy Chow.
You're listening to CITR 101.9 FM.